you're recording?
Yes, okay, it is recording now. This is an interview with Barry Powell, who is in Michigan at the time, and I am in Columbus, Ohio, in Care Buick. And so we'll just start with kind of where you grew up. Where you
you're in Columbus, Ohio?
Yes, I am.
You mean you're one of those guys from down there calling a Wolverine?
Well, I am not a Buckeye, nor do I associate with the Buckeyes.
Yeah. Okay, I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. Yeah, so where were you born and raised?
I was born in a suburb of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Oh, really? Which one?
Bellevue.
Mm-hmm.
And I was raised there and also on the north side because my father died when I was three, so my mother had to, you know, move. And we lived with my grandmother and two aunts for a while, and then she got her own apartment. We moved back to Bellevue, and we stayed there, and she met my father, my stepfather, and they got married. Then we moved out to the North Hills area, which is north of Pittsburgh, needless to say, North Hills area.
And did you have any brothers and sisters?
No, I don't have any child.
And what did your mom do?
She was a secretary.
What about your stepfather?
My stepfather worked for the Eglinton Gas Company. It's a gas company in Pittsburgh at the time, which serviced gas appliances as well as delivering gas to the to your door and stuff like that. But they also had appliances like stoves, refrigerators, etc. And then after a while, he quit that, and then he and another man went into business themselves into an appliance company, actually, where they were selling and doing repairs for air conditioning, heaters, furnaces, etc., etc., which until he retired.
And would you say your childhood was average childhood? Did you have, exceptional childhood, or how would you characterize
it? I don't know. I guess it was an average childhood. I didn't have a father to identify with from the age of 4 to 10. I attended a Catholic school for the first 3 grades, and then when my mother got married, we moved over to the North Hills, and then I started the public school over there. And I graduated from Westview High School at the time, which now is just a little thing called a middle school, because they built a nice big high school there.
And how long, what point did you become interested in nursing or in the medical field in general?
This is a very circuitous route. For some reason, and I can't remember, when I was probably in the 10th or 11th grade, I decided I want to be a psychiatrist, believe it or not. And in our senior high school at that time, we had our senior year, our one course was divided in sociology for one semester and problems of democracy for the second semester. In our sociology course, one of the field trips we took was down to one of the Pennsylvania State Hospitals for the mentally ill, which is down by Swickley, which is another suburb of Pittsburgh. And we went down there, and we made the rounds of the hospital and saw some of the patients and some of the wards and that kind of stuff. And that furthered my interest in being a head shrink. And I graduated from high school and I went to Penn State. The first year I was there, I really wanted to go to the University of Pennsylvania, but my mother and father couldn't afford it. So I went to Penn State. This is probably why I did this, to get back at them. Anyway, I went to Penn State and I enrolled, had German and all that kind of stuff. And when I was in high school, I joined a club in Pittsburgh called Explorers Club of Pittsburgh, which did a lot of things like mountain climbing and things like that. But the thing that I got interested in was cave exploring, spelunking. And I became an avid spelunker. So when I went to Penn State, I got up to State College, and they had a grotto up there called Nittany Grotto, which was their cell of the National Speleological Society. So all I did the first year was cave explore, so I flunked. And so they told me to cool school for the next year. So the next year, my sophomore year, I worked in the girls' dormitory, freshman dormitory, so needless to say, I didn't do anything then. So they told me to take a leave of absence for 6 months and think it over. Well, anyhow, in the meantime, after I graduated from high school that summer before I went to Penn State, I went down to Six Mont State Hospital and I got a job as an orderly. And I did that the following year, and I did it the third year. In other words, after my sophomore year in college, and I eventually became the head of the men's violent ward, you would call it. I used to have fun. I used to work up 3-11 and unlock all these guys, you know, that are murderers and all that kind of stuff. Because, you know, remember, I wanted to be a psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
And I never had any problems with them, but Miss Davis, the head nurse, chief nurse then, she called me one day. She says, Barry, she says, you've got to lock these guys up before what's his name comes on from 11 o'clock because he's scared enough. In the meantime, I met a young man there my second year there named Bill Fulton, and he was a full-time aide. Well, when I was told not to come back to college, it was 1954 and the draft was on and there was, you know, still the things in Korea going on. And I thought about, what can I do? I still want medicine, but evidently I'm not supposed to be a physician, so let's see what happens. Well, Bill, several months before, left, Bill Fulton, the guy I was telling you about, he left and went to Philadelphia. And went into the Pennsylvania Hospital School of Nursing for Men, which I looked into, and it turns out that essentially two of the 3 years at that time, you spent psychiatric nursing. And I thought, well, this is a pretty good deal, so I interviewed there, and I was accepted, and I went there to Pennsylvania Hospital School of Nursing for 3 years. And I graduated. Our second year, we did go down to what was called Aiken Spruce, which is the main Pennsylvania hospital, which is actually the oldest hospital in the country, run by Dr. Benjamin Russell and Benjamin Franklin. And it's still there today. My school of nursing was closed many, many years ago, and there was a girls' school also at 8th Street and Pennsylvania Hospital, and that was also closed many years ago. So there's no school of nursing there anymore. I did that, and I thought, well, you know, I might like to go in the Army. You know, I kind of delayed it because of Korea. I mean, Korea because of going to nursing school, so I felt that I owed the country.
Sorry, that was my dog.
I owe my country some service. Like, you know, we say, should we get the draft back? Because if you don't want to be bored, you can do some service or something like that. So I felt, I had been fortunate, man. Into the Army. I became a head nurse at Pennsylvania Hospital. The interesting thing was Pennsylvania Hospital, 844, where the men's school was, where we spent our 2 years, was a private hospital. We had many people there and at the Institute, like the MDF and all this kind of stuff. And so I graduated, and they asked me if I would like to work on the women's side. Now, you have to understand, this is 1957, and there was the men's side and there's the women's side. The men always worked on the men's side. The men never worked on the women's side.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we had nine other schools of nursing where they would send their students for their 3 years of psychiatric nursing. And, you know, 99% of them were women. In fact, that's how I met my wife. She was one of my students. So anyhow, the women worked on the women's side, but on the other hand, they worked on the men's side, too.
Mm-hmm.
Full discrimination there. So the chief of the nurse at that time asked me if I would like to go and work on the women's side. So I went over to the women's side as an assistant head nurse on a, I would say, a semi-combative ward. They weren't locked up all the time, but there was a lot of trouble. And then I eventually became the head nurse. And then in May of 1958, I went into the Army, and I went to Fort Sam Houston for Base and Training. And my first assignment was Fort Eustis, Virginia. And I was hoping they'd head of a psychiatric service there, but they didn't. They had a psychiatrist, but they didn't have any need for a psychiatric nurse. So I was in medical surgical nursing. And in the meantime, I was dating my two wife-to-be in Philadelphia, which is only like 300 miles away. And we eventually decided to get married when I became a first lieutenant, because instead of making $210 a month as a second lieutenant, I would be making the fabulous sum of $260 a month. And so that's what we did. We waited until I became a first lieutenant. We got married. And we lived for a few months in Williamsburg, Virginia. We got married in November of 59. We lived in Williamsburg, Virginia. And Red Cross from Phi Beta Kappa Hall on the campus of William Mary, which I don't know if you've ever been there. It's a beautiful place. Needless to say, it's gotten too touristy in the last 20 years. Meanwhile, I had a couple of classmates and gentlemen in front of me who went into anesthesia. And this kind of intrigued me, so I said to Pat, I said, you know, in a few more months, i.e. May of 61, or 1960, I will have my 2 years in. And what do you think? Would you like to stay in the Army at least for a while, or maybe make a career of it? She said yes. She had been down to the military post here at Fort Eustis many times when she was visiting me. And the nurses were real nice. The lady nurses, they put them up in the female dorm. I was the only man there, so I just, you know, slept with the regular badger officers' quarters. And so she got to know some of them, and she got to know some of my friends who needed to stay. They were all military, and she liked it, you know. So we decided to stay in the Army.
And you said you had met her in nursing school?
Yes, she was still in nursing school. I was the head nurse on that women's ward, and she was rotating through there.
Did she give any thought to joining the Army Nurse Corps as well, or did she like civilian nursing?
No, she did. In fact, when we were in Italy, the chief nurse at the time actually asked her if she'd like to join the North Nurse Corps, and she said no. She was working as a civilian. She didn't want to. Anyhow, I thought, well, I gotta really look into this anesthesia. So we had a couple nurse anesthetists, both of them were young ladies, in our little operating room. So I went up and told them, you know, what I was thinking about, and they said, well, sure. So I spent, I don't know, 3 or 4 days with them on and off, watching them anesthetize people, et cetera, et cetera. And I became quite enamored with this subject. So I went to Washington, D.C., since I was too close. And I went to the Surgeon General's office, and I went and introduced myself to Colonel, I forget what her name is. And I told her that I wanted to go to anesthesia school. And this was in March of 1960. And she said, well, thank you for Lieutenant Powell. You'll probably be able to get in with your credentials and grades, et cetera, et cetera. But it's going to be at least the class of a year, year and a half from now. And I said, well, that's okay. I'll stay at Fort Eustis, Virginia. Well, I got back, and 3 weeks later, I had orders to go to anesthesia school at Letterman Army Medical Center in San Francisco. So we upped and went to San Francisco, and I did my year of anesthesia there. My best friend, and actually I was the best man in their wedding, John, he also went into anesthesia school, and he went to the same place, but he went 6 months ahead of us. So there were six of us in our class. We had one lady, and we had five men. And I just saw in the ANA bulletin a couple months ago, somebody put our picture in there as some of the first men in nursing in anesthesia. I certainly wasn't the first nurse in the Army. Men had been in the Army even in the Second World War as nurses. They were, you know, commissioned officers. The first one was commissioned in 1956. I think when I joined, I was like, the, I don't know, it was 150th or something that, that had joined nurse.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a lot of us around. And just like the civilian counterpart of nursing and anesthesia, quite a few men go into that.
Uh-huh. Why do you think that is?
I think it's probably the challenge of the scientific thing and being on a one-to-one basis with a patient. I remember somebody saying to me one time, in fact, the young lady that dropped out of our class, she said she couldn't stand patients asleep. She likes to talk to patients, and that just drove her crazy. She wasn't talking to her. And on the other hand, I felt that there was no more challenging of aspect of nursing, i.e. even medicine, except for surgery and that, but certainly in nursing, as to be able to relate on a personal, intimate basis with one individual and their family, and then take them to the operating room and give them a bunch of poison and knocking them out, and if you made a mistake, you killed them, and then turn around and reverse it all.
Right.
And so when somebody says to me, you don't want to talk to patients, you don't want to rapport with patients, I really beg to differ, and I don't think that you can have a rapport much more closely than what I just described to you.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So we did the first year at Letterman. At that time, the anesthesia program in the Army, just like the civilian life, had gone from 6 months to 1 year. But the Army, not to be outdone, had what was called a preceptorship, which was like another year. And so I then was transferred at the end of my first year, i.e. in 1961, to Manikin Army Medical Center in Tacoma, Washington, where I was a preceptor, and there was another preceptor 6 months ahead of me, and there was, and we were there for a year, and there was another preceptor who came in 6 months after us, and he and his wife have turned out to be our best friends. And after the Army, we still travel back to Europe and all that kind of stuff. Like we're going on down the Caribbean on next year in September. But anyhow, so I was there for a year. And the difference in the preceptorship over the actual anesthesia course, there were no classes to take or anything like that. You got the pick of the cases before anybody else because, you wanted to get more experience in this preceptorship. You presented some M&Ms and things like that normal staff people didn't do.
Mm-hmm. And what are those? And what were those?
M&M?
Uh-huh.
Morbidity and mortality. In other words, case reviews.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
Get the department together and say, today I'm going to review a case that I had yesterday with Joe Blow Kokomo, and I was taking this kid's tonsils out, and he bled and bled and bled and bled and bled. What did we do?
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
So we didn't have any formal classes, but we did get the pick of, we got the pick of everything.
Mm-hmm.
Then I got orders to go to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, not in the prison, but to the hospital. And there was an anesthesiologist and two nurse anesthetists, myself and a lady there. And that was nice because I had gone from two general hospitals to a very small hospital, which had very interesting patients because it was the Fort Leavenworth, if you don't know about it, is the Command and General Staff College of the United States Army. So the faculty there are well-renowned military people, and the students are also there to learn, a lot about stuff.
Mm-hmm.
From the CGNS, then you go to the War College or the National. There's several things in that. But anyhow, I stayed there for a year, and then lo and behold, I had orders to go to Italy. So I packed my wife, my young daughter, my wife who was pregnant with our second daughter, and we flew to Italy. We spent 3 wonderful years in Italy, and we still go back, like I say, with our friends. We were just back a couple years ago. We spent 3 years in Italy, and at that time, let's see, when did it happen? Oh, before I went to Italy, I went back to the Pentagon, and I forget exactly where it was, and I laid out what I wanted to do with my career. They said to me, Captain, Well, what do you want to do? Write it down. So I said, well, I'd like to go overseas. I'd like to back at my bachelor's degree. Then I'd like to go to the advanced course. Then I'd like to go into anesthesia education, get my master's degree, et cetera, et cetera. I said, fine. So I didn't think anything about it. Anyhow, in Italy, the chief nurse came around. Irene, and that's the one that asked my wife if she wanted to be a nurse in the Army, and she said no. My nurse was, my wife was working in the OBGYN unit.
Mm-hmm.
Daughter there. And so I told Mildred, I said, I'd like to go back and get finish my degree, and then I'd like to go back to San Antonio. I'd like to go to San Antonio, and I would like to become, at that time, there was a course director, an assistant course director, and now the course has gone from a year to a year and a half. And then I'd like to go to the advanced course, and I'd like to get my master's degree, yak, yak, yak. And I said, okay. So I had orders, and I came back, and I went to University of Nebraska, University of Omaha, Nebraska. And I got my BS in nursing, and I was there for about 6 months because I had a lot of credits from Penn State and some other credits too, so I finished in 6 to 7 months. I went to Fort Sam Houston, and I worked there for a while in the Beach Pavilion. There were two pavilions. There was the main hospital, and the Beach Pavilion was an annex. I used another hospital by itself, which specialties were orthopedics and neurosurgery and thoracic surgery, that kind of stuff. And I'll never remember, I'll never forget, because this is now, you know, this is before that, okay. So anyhow, I went and became an assistant course director. I worked in the staff, and in 6 months, I went to the officer's advanced course, which is another way to get your ticket punched. The next one after that would be the Command and General Staff College, which I didn't go to.
Mm-hmm.
I went to that, and then I came back, and then I became the assistant course director at the nurse anesthesia course for a while. And that's when I was talking about Beach Pavilion. That then, of course, was, we're talking now, 1967, 1968, 1969.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll never forget Henry Gonzalez, who was representative of to the United States Congress from the San Antonio area, came around to the Beach Pavilion. And if you may remember, I said there's several things there, like neurosurgery, thoracic surgery, and orthopedics. And he went and saw the number of orthopedic casualties we had from Vietnam. Their beds were so close together they couldn't even move, and he was just enraged by it. And we would get the guys from Vietnam, the orthopedic patients, they would be airlifted over to Hawaii, and then eventually to where they lived, you know, Denver, to a hospital in Denver, or San Francisco, or Walter Reed in Washington, or whatever. And of course, we got people who were in the Texas area and those states, so they would be nearest home. Get called in the middle of the night and have to come out and give anesthesia because they would be airlifted from Hawaii, and some of them had very minimal care, and then we would unwrap their dressings and the smell was just terrible because there was gangrene and all that, and we ended up doing a lot of debridement. You know what debridement is?
Mm-hmm.
The way dead skin and all that kind of stuff. Doing anesthesia. So anyhow, by this time I thought it was time for me to go to the home. And I was all prepared to, and I talked to the consultant Surgeon General at that time, and Ira says, okay, we'll send you to Vietnam. She says, no, I don't want you to go to Vietnam. She says, I want you to go get your master's degree. And I said, oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. So you had volunteered and said, I want to go.
Yeah, I said, it's time for me to go. All my buddies are going, and they're asking me, who do I know that I don't go? Some of them have been over there twice. And I got orders. I put in for three schools, Boston College, University of Pittsburgh, and I forget what else, and I decided to, since I was from Pittsburgh, to go back to the University of Pittsburgh. So I went back there from April of 69 to May of 71, about 26 months or something, and I got my master's in nursing. Then after that, I went to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. did you think about the war at that point?
About the war at that point?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I really didn't think anything about it. I knew we were in a war, and I was hoping we would get out of it because so many people were getting killed. I guess at that time I still had so much feeling of national service in that I just didn't question why we were there,
mm-hmm.
how we ended up, which would be different nowadays if I was going to go to Iraq. But anyhow, I went over, and I went to the 67th back in Fubai, which is north of Da Nang, over the Hai Nam Pass, if you know where that is, in south of Wei, the old capital city. And I spent 6 months there, and you have to remember now, this is 71, and things are winding down over there.
Mm-hmm.
And so we didn't have the casualties like John, my classmate, you know, he was at place not place in my lie or whatever, not my lie, where, you know, they went like 96 hours without sleeping because
mm-hmm.
big run over they had by Kaysan, yeah,
uh-huh.
By Kaysan. We didn't have any. The most casualties I got at one time was like 8 or 9. the most memorable two things that happened over there was this young gentleman got flown in by helicopter because we were right beside the airfield, and there was a medevac stationed right there. So they flew this GI, and he was like 22 years old, and I got called to the emergency room, and he had been shot by one of his own men. He was out on the perimeter on guard, and somebody came up and shot him with an M15. We don't know why. And so we were needed to resuscitate him because he was bleeding. And we put 4 large bore IVs in him, 1 in each arm, 1 in each leg. And I'll never forget, you know, talking to the man. And I said to him, son, you know, I have to put a breathing tube down in your throat to breathe for you. And I can't give you an anesthetic because if I do, it's not going to be good for you. He said, okay, sir. So he opened his mouth. And I put the tube in. And then I, you know, talked to him then. But finally, the surgeon opened his chest. And by this time, you know, he really didn't know what was going on, though he was still alive. And then we found that the subclavian artery on the left-hand side had been hit, so all the blood we were putting was just bleeding out from there. And we got up to 75 units of blood, and he just didn't make it. The other thing at that time, too, was I was over there when fragging was going on, though we didn't have anybody fragged. You know what I mean by fragging?
Yeah,
okay. We didn't get anybody fragged in our area. We got a couple from, we were there supporting one of the brigades of the 82nd Airborne at Camp Hockmouth down the road. But the other thing was, at this time now, we had the heroin and cocaine stuff, which was being smuggled in, I guess, by the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong. And I would get called to the emergency room at least once a week to resuscitate somebody, you know, that OD'd.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting is you never know who would be there, because one day I went over there and I resuscitated this guy, and here was one of the guys, one of the OR techs that I worked with in the daytime. And he had OD'd, and he actually died because we couldn't resuscitate him. Then I came home from Christmas, and things at that place were kind of quiet. And I came home from Christmas, and I came back. I went up to play coup for my last 6 months up in the Central Highlands, which is a very nice area. And again, not much going on. A little more frightful than Fubai, because the hospital at Plei Khu sat above the airfield, and then further up the mountain were a couple of microwave antennae. These are huge things, like 50 by 60 feet, which would take the microwaves coming from, like, Fubai, where I was, in the northern part of southern South Vietnam, up to Plei Khu, and then microwave messages and stuff down to Saigon. And when I got there, the American support troops had pulled out because the war was really winding down. And they used to have a battery of 105s up there, and people tell me when Charlie shot his rockets off, why, from the Ashaw Valley, why, you know, we'd open up and two or three rounds and they'd stop. Well, what happens is Charlie went out there in the Eshowe Valley, that's on the, over towards Cambodia, and he shoot those 122 rockets, you know?
Mm-hmm.
If you know what those were, they were very inaccurate. They set them up in a tree, you know, the launch thing up against the tree and all that kind of stuff, and was just kind of aim and shoot. And what they aimed for, of course, was the microwave antenna, because they were so big. And they figured if they shoot right over that, about 6 feet, the thing's going to land on the airfield. Well, every once in a while, they landed in the hospital.
Mm-hmm. And is this, which hospital is this in Pleiku? Is this the 71st?
I forget what the name of it was. The other one's the 67th. I forget what the one in Pleiku was called.
Mm-hmm. I know the 71st evac, but I think there was another smaller one in Pleiku or near Pleiku as well.
It was in a back hospital. I can't remember.
Hmm.
But anyhow, so we every once in a while have rockets going over and that, but other
mm-hmm.
kind of, still, it was two anesthetists there, too. At the other place, there was actually an anesthesiologist, two nurse anesthetists, and the anesthesiologist left, and there was a gal and myself there, and then when I went up to Pleiku, they had already pulled the anesthesiologist, and it was just Ed Lauer and I. He was the other nurse anesthetist, so it was just the two of us. And then I got a drop 3 weeks before my bureau, in other words, date of separation from Vietnam, I got about 3 weeks earlier. And when I did, they actually were evacuating on my plane, a C-150 or C-1, whatever it was. They were evacuating some of the civilians that had been friendly with the Americans because the next town up the road was Khartoum, and Charlie was saying he was going to come down there again and overrun the Pleiku. So there were a lot of people on there with me to not understand. With the next day, all the female personnel from the hospital were evacuated. And then I guess a few days later, the hospital was actually closed down, and everybody moved down to Quezon or something. And they reopened the hospital, I guess, a month or so later because Charlie never came, but they never sent any women back there. It was just men and that. It was interesting because when we were up there, as I said, there were no Americans around, so we used to go over to the garbage dump and shoot 57-millimeter recoilless rifles and machine guns in it, so we would protect ourselves because we were told if Charlie comes down, we, i.e. the staff of that hospital, were going to have to protect ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
But that was fun, so we went out and did a lot of shooting.
Uh-huh. And was that just the men, or did the women go too?
The women didn't go.
Mm-hmm. Was that policy, or was it just kind of what happened?
I don't think any of them wanted to. I don't think there was any policy that they couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
I think one did go, to come to think about it. I think one did go. But most of them, yeah, I'm not into guns and stuff like that. So.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Luckily, that never happened. Then I came back to the United States.
Mm-hmm. And what was your rank by this point? You'd been in the Army for quite a while.
I made major when I was in at the University of Nebraska. I made major.
Mm-hmm.
And, when I was in when I left Vietnam in 1971, I was promotable to lieutenant colonel.
Mm-hmm. So you ranked higher than most of the nurses who were on staff at that time, right?
Yes. I was the ranking person. But remember in Pleiku, there were only about 8 or 10 nurses. It wasn't like a big, you know, big hospital.
Uh-huh.
Even at the other hospital in Phu Bai, I think there were only like 10 or 15 of us. And I was the major, and the chief nurse there, John Garland, he was a lieutenant colonel. And then he eventually came back, and then he became a colonel. Then he retired before I did.
Mm-hmm.
So then I came back, and I went back to Manigan Army Medical Center in Tacoma, Washington. I became the assistant. I was supposed to take over the anesthesia program. Now, by now, the anesthesia program had changed. If you remember, I said it started out in 6 months, then a year, then a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, all this is going on, they opened what they call a phase one and a phase two program at William Beaumont Hospital in El Paso. They opened what was called the phase one. So all the nurse anesthesia students would go to William Beaumont for 6 months, and they'd have the majority of their didactic work there.
Mm-hmm.
With very little clinical experience. Then for the next, now the course is now 2 years. Then for the next year and a half, they would go to other places for their phase two. They go to Letterman in San Francisco. They would go to Madigan. They'd go to the one in Denver, I forget the name of it. Of course, they would stay also in El Paso. And they would also go to Walter Reed for their second month. So I was up there to take over as the course director of phase two. But Frank Mazziarski, who is there, and Frank is now the president-elect of the ANA, and so he's been around a while too, and he retired from the military, went up to Tacoma. And Frank was going to go to the University of Washington to get his PhD, but something happened and he got delayed. So they couldn't put me in his place, so they made me the assistant chief of the department, which was fine for a year. And then Frank went on up to the University of Washington, started a doctorate, but he didn't finish it. And then I took over the program of nurse anesthesia until maybe 1973 to 1976. And I got orders. The anesthesia consultant at that time was a man. And he came up and I told him, you know, I kind of wanted to stay there and retire at Tacoma because we like it so well. Well, no sooner had he gone back home than I got orders to go to Fort Sill, Oklahoma. And so I called one of the brass in Washington who I know, Pat Miller. And I said, Pat, this is a waste of time for me who's been in education now for send me to Fort Sill to be a chief nurse anesthetist. And she said, oh, okay, we'll see what we can do. And I got orders to go to Fort Sam Houston, back to San Antonio again. And this time I became the chief of the phase one of the anesthesia program. And what they were going to do was move the phase one from William Beaumont to the academy, because all the courses are at the academy, the basic courses for officers and enlisted, the advanced courses, etc., etc. So they wanted it under one roof. So I rewrote the POI, Program of Instruction, updated it, you know, what we were going to teach, and another gentleman, Joe Rando, came over from Beaumont, and we opened the first course there. And while I was there, I went to Hawaii to see about opening a phase two over there, which we did. And I went to Fort Benning, Georgia Hospital to see about opening a phase two there, which we did. So we had more phase twos, which meant we could take larger classes. And I think our first class had like 45 students. And again, with phase one, they took all their science courses, et cetera, physical assessment, and things like that. Did very little in the operating room. And there was at that time then the possibility of pushing for a master's degree for the program.
Mm-hmm.
And we were looking at the University of Texas, and I was talking to my compatriots at the nurse anesthesia program at the Air Force over at Randolph Air Force Base, and he agreed with me, and he said, you know, this is kind of silly duplicating. Here's two separate courses, the Air Force, Army, you know, within 10 miles of each other. And what we ought to do is get both of these together for phase one and also use it for phase two and see about getting a master's program and all that kind of stuff. So we were working on it, and I had my second class. And then, in the meantime, I had been, for several years, had been a on-site visitor and a senior on-site visitor for the Council on Accreditation of Nurse Anesthesia. Do you know what that is?
I've heard of the organization, but
That's the one that does the accreditation for your program. At that time, gave you 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, or 4 years, or probation, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Now they go, I think now as long as 10 years or something. But you would go out to hospitals, the eventually you became a senior reviewer, and if the program deemed it by the location or notoriety or whatever, you'd also have an anesthesiologist go with you.
Mm-hmm.
And at this time, I really didn't know what I wanted to do. I had put in for my doctoral degree at the University of Texas two times to the Army, and they turned me down. And, well, by then I had 18 years in, you know, and I'm saying, well, you know, this is silly, because if I go get my doctor in 2 years, that's going to be 2 years for that, and I owe them two for one, so I'll be in for another 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what they did, they sent another guy who happened to be in my nursing class at the University of Pittsburgh, Joe Maloney, and they sent him. Now, Joe was a good-looking boy, knew how to flick his eyes at the gal, though, excuse me. And I know what his grade average was, and my grade average was, in the University of Pittsburgh. And I was invited to join Sigma Theta Tau, which is the National Honor Society of Nursing. And he was, so I'm saying, so he knows something like that. So he got selected the first year. In the second year, they selected, Halliburton, who was a gal who was in with the girls. And she got selected to go, and they prepared her, and she eventually came and took over the phase one when I left. And I understand she lasted about a year, and she had a nerve breakdown, which anybody could have told, but anyhow, that's beside the point. So anyhow, I'm getting this, you know, I'm getting turned down for the doctoral program, and I know I'm going to have to leave, and I'm thinking what's going on, and I got a call from the council to come up to interview me to review the program under anesthesia at the University of Michigan. And, not the University of Michigan, Jefferson Medical College in Philadelphia. And since the head of anesthesia there, Dr. Jacoby, was well known throughout the country, they decided to send an anesthesiologist, Tom DeCornfield, who was from the University of Michigan. And then I had an assistant, and we went and, you know, we did it, and the program really had to close and everything. And of course, I had to very graciously front Dr. Jacoby. Very nice way that, you know, this program really is easy to close it. So I did that, and afterwards Tom said to me, I really am impressed in the way that you handled it.
Uh-huh.
Well, thank you. And it was a couple weeks later, I got a phone call from him, and he said, the head of the program up here has been dismissed. He was caught with a couple of his students, you know. And would you be interested in coming up, because the assistant doesn't want to stay. She was going to, but she decided not to, and review the job. So I flew up, and my wife came, and we reviewed the place and the program, et cetera, et cetera. And eventually it came up a second time, that, and eventually I called Washington, and I talked to my friend Pat Miller, who I talked to before, and I said, Pat, I wanted you to know that going to retire in May, except for the job at the University of Pittsburgh. I had told them before that I was looking, a few months before.
Mm-hmm.
I first got contacted. So I have to be honest with you, I've been contacted, you know, I'm looking at a possible educational position.
Mm-hmm.
And Pat said, well, Barry, she said, you know, you don't know what we have planned for you. And I said, well, I know I don't know, because nobody responded to the little, you know, hint that I was looking. And she says, well, we are planning to move you to Washington to be the chief at Walter Reed and home to the Surgeon General for nurse anesthesia. And I said, well, thank you very much. I realize it's the number one job in nurse anesthesia in the Army, but I really want to stay in education. Though I would have been in education there, but I would still be in administration. There was a director of phase two there.
Mm-hmm.
So being the consultant to the Surgeon General means that you have to be responsible for moving to nurse anesthetist to different assignments, and then, you know, getting a call saying, well, I can't stay here, I got to go near home because my mother's dying or this is going on. Then you move that person, and you have to move somebody to fill that person, you know what I mean?
Right.
And all that kind of stuff. People want special things in there. So I decided that I would go ahead and retire and come up to the University. and I had like a 3.9 average.
Big hospital out there that hope they're all over the place, you know what I mean?
1991. The force were over in France, and then we were going down to Spain, and then we were going to go back to Italy. We had been there for a couple of years. And in Spain, I decided to have a stroke. And so our vacation was cut short, and we went back and spent the an extra week in Paris and flew back. So needless to say, after that, I didn't work again, so I haven't been working since then.
Mm-hmm.
Rose, I was very fortunate. Today we were going to leave to go to Barcelona and take an overnight train to Milano.
Mm-hmm.
Not when we went to the bathroom, I went back to sleep, and I woke up and I said, "What happened? I'm having a stroke." And so they called the ambulance, and people say to me, "Well, gee, what was it like having a stroke like that in Spain?" And I said, "Well, they did everything right. They came and got me Pat in the meantime to give me some aspirin. I had been on Plavix, and the doctor in the ambulance said, you shouldn't have given him aspirin. You might have killed him if it was a bleed." My hypertension guy said, "Probably saving my life."
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, I went to the hospital. I was completely paralyzed on the right side. I had expressive aphasia. Expressive aphasia, you know what you want to say, but control it, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And they did the right thing. They took a CAT scan on me. They gave me medicine. They didn't give me the TPA, and which some people say you should have within 4 hours, because in Europe they feel that that's not completely, really set in concrete that that should be done.
Mm-hmm.
And then they took another CAT scan 48 hours later, and sure enough, there was a lesion there in my middle cerebral artery on my left side. In the meantime, my expressive aphasia went, my paralysis in my left leg went. I just had kind of a drooping arm, which I came back and told PT for.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, except I can't write, but other than that, I can just, I really can't. I couldn't start an IV or... That's kind of a nutshell.
Mm-hmm. And so, what have you been doing since then? Just family things, or are you still active in different organizations?
Yeah, I'm active in my church, Christ. I usually go over and print the bulletin.
Mm-hmm.
Relieve one of the secretaries if they want a day off or something comes up, they have to have a doctor's appointment or something like that, and I help out with vacation Bible school.
Uh-huh.
The rest of the time, I spend a lot of time on the internet. We do a lot of traveling.
Uh-huh.
I'm still working. She has a nice job. And I don't know if I want her to quit because I'm, she's kind of keeping me at the level of living that I'm getting accustomed to.
Uh-huh.
She is interestingly, Pat never went and got her degree. She's a 3-year degree graduate.
Uh-huh.
And she's at the University of Michigan. She's the nurse manager of the Clinical Research Center. The Clinical Research Center is about 75 of them in the country, and they're at medical centers, and they're completely funded by the NIH. In fact, they're going through the renewal. They renew every 4 years. And their last time was like $35 million. And they even rent the space in the university. They pay the university the money to pay the salaries and all that kind of stuff. And so she has a very responsible and prestigious job when you consider that down there all the head nurses have master's degrees.
Yeah.
So anyhow, that's it. So we just we travel around and...
I've written down some notes of things that you mentioned that I wanted to go back over a little bit more too. I didn't want to interrupt your narrative as you were going along.
You're not a TIA.
You mentioned that your nursing school was an all-male nursing school, is that right?
Yeah, there were two divisions. There was the girls.
Mm-hmm.
They were down at 8th Street.
Uh-huh.
And they did their med-surg nursing down there for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And for 3 months they did their pediatrics out at St. Christopher's. Not St. Christopher's, Children's Hospital, Philadelphia, CHOP. The men would go down there their second year, and we would get our mid-surge, certainly not as much as they did.
Uh-huh.
They, in turn, would come out to our place for 3 months of psychiatric nursing.
Mm-hmm. showed up that the men and women had more emphasis on different aspects of nursing.
Right.
By the school.
The men was definitely psychiatric, and the women's was medical surgical.
That's interesting.
Now, we were the first class of men. Now, the men's school was founded in 1927 by Leroy Craig. He was still alive when I went there. We were the first class of men to do two things. One, start a pediatric affiliation. They had never been done before because it wasn't a requirement in the Pennsylvania State Nurses, you know, the Board of Nursing exam.
Mm-hmm.
That became a requirement when I was in nursing school. Secondly, another requirement came that you needed to have experience in OBGYN, OB.
Uh-huh.
Albeit it was only like 10 hours or something like that. So we were the first ones to go. We didn't go to Children's Hospital, Pennsylvania. We went to St. Christopher's, another hospital in Philadelphia.
Uh-huh.
And did our 3 months of pediatric, and then when we were at 8th Street, across the street there was Women's Hospital of Pennsylvania, which is right across the street from Pennsylvania Hospital. And we were the first men to be in, quote, OB.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all this was something, these guys coming in here, all this kind of stuff, and what we were allowed to do, we were allowed to be in the labor room, you know, that was all. We didn't go in. Assist with deliveries or see deliveries or anything like that, which of course now has completely changed.
Mm-hmm.
That was, that was a first.
Uh-huh. How were you received when you went to Pete's and then to OB?
Fine.
Mm-hmm.
The women nurses didn't have a problem with it, and the patients didn't have any problems with it.
Mm-hmm.
I was a little surprised, but you know.
Mm-hmm.
There, the doctors, majority of them were men, so I guess it really didn't make any difference to them. Again, we weren't doing it, and we were taking fetal heart sounds, you know, vital signs, and that was it. This was before they went into the delivery room.
And did you face, or did your class as a whole face stigma because you were male nurses, or did you find that people had certain stereotypes about male nurses, or did you?
Oh yeah, there were things about that. Of course, in Philadelphia, and having 9 different schools of nursing rotating out to our place for psychiatric nursing. There were 9 schools there: Chestnut Hill, University of Pennsylvania, University of Pennsylvania Hospital, and several other ones that I don't think any of them had any men in there. Since then they have, of course, and I guess, you know, having rotated out there, they got to know us and found out that, you know, we were just like any other guy. In fact, I would wager 95% of the guys at my hospital out here at 44th Street married women that they met on affiliation. People, would, you know, if you talk to somebody who wasn't familiar with medicine, say, what do you do? I'm a nurse. Well, what do you mean you're a nurse? What do you do? Oh yeah, okay. And I remember one time somebody either asked me or my wife, in all seriousness, when we went up to Madigan after we were lettermen, we went up to Madigan for our second year, and you know, different people were wondering about, you know, what these nurses were, though they had heard and they really hadn't seen any. They asked me, or they asked my wife, well, now do you have a capping ceremony? Will you get a cap?
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a capping ceremony. We don't have a caping ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I know a couple of GYN guys. His wife was kind of funny, and that turned out. She turned out to be a nice friend, and the officers' club up there, my wife got elected as vice president, so I guess it was acceptable. You know, you hear these things, and of course, you yourself run into, I had several guys in the Army that I worked with that turned out to be homosexual and all that kind of stuff, and of course, you know, gave the rest of us a bad name, and I guess today might not be bad, I don't know, but I know one that, you know, asked to leave the Army, and he went out to the airport and solicited other men out at the airport. We think he did it on purpose so he would get discharged.
Mm-hmm.
It was always that, you know, that people thought, well, you know, you're queer because you go in the Army, or you're feminine or something like that. that. But I think that passed over the year or so I was in the Army, as more and more men came in, and again, more and more went into anesthesia.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly in the Army, it became more acceptable. And so there's still not that many men that go into nursing. Like, I think down here at the University of Michigan, we have, maybe there's three or four in the nursing school. We have several nurses, men that work in the hospital. In fact, my urologist who takes care of me, because of my stroke, she runs the stroke clinic. When I first met her in 91, her husband was actually getting his master's degree in nursing.
Mm-hmm.
From the University of Michigan, and I said, aha, it's reverse time now. I think was disappointed.
Uh-huh.
I went to, you know, going to nursing, all that kind of stuff. And then as I got more education and all that kind of stuff, she would say to people, well, you know, he's just not a nurse now. He's an anesthetist, and he's teaching the people to teach the people and all that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
But I really never let it bother me.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And you think that's changed now?
Pardon?
You think that perception has changed now?
Oh, yeah, I think so, though I still feel that there is still a feeling of somewhat of homosexuality with men in nursing.
Mm-hmm.
I know some of them went down here at the University of Michigan, you know, or on that, but they're accepted, I think, for who they are and what they are.
Uh-huh.
Nurses, and I don't think they're discriminated against. I can't honestly say that I was ever discriminated against in any way because